We compared those bags, or we had the laboratory compared those bags to the bags that were found on Jennifer and on Jennifer's body. It was determined that the bags that were available to Stanley were commercial bags. They are not the bags that you'd buy off the shelf at the grocery store.
In 1990, our laboratory was not doing any DNA analysis.
Would it be correct to say that DNA analysis was kind of in its infancy in 1990?
The Stanley Liggins trial had a CSI moment Friday. A scientist with the Iowa Department of Criminal Investigation said the trash bag that Jennifer Lewis was burned in was a chemical match for the bags available at the Hillside Inn where Liggins lived. Paul Bush said that unlike other trash bags tested, the bag that Jennifer was wrapped in and those at the Hillside Inn contained titanium. Here is how former Scott County attorney Bill Davis described the significance of the bags in an interview with Suspect Convictions last year.
We found plastic bags in the well way in the staircase underneath the apartment where Stanley Liggins was living. We compared those bags, or we had the laboratory compared those bags to the bags that were found on Jennifer and on Jennifer's body. It was determined that the bags that were available to Stanley were commercial bags. They are not the bags that you'd buy off the shelf at the grocery store. They're a different size, different allotments, and it's the chemist who was called to testify stated that that's what he found. They were commercial bags and they would not be available on a grocery store shelf.
But the significance of what the evidence the crime lab found may well have been overshadowed by what it did not find. In anticipation of defense criticism, Scott County Attorney Mike Walton questioned criminalist Paul Bush about DNA testing in 1990.
Was the lab doing DNA analysis at all in 1990?
In 1990, our laboratory was not doing any DNA analysis. I was doing some research with my thesis program at the time, but our laboratory per se was not doing DNA testing.
And in the history of law enforcement using DNA commonly in their investigations, in 1990, where were we at?
In 1990, we were basically, and within the country, looking at one type of DNA analysis that was just coming online, really, in the United States at the time. Again, our laboratory was not capable of doing that testing. There was a lot of what I would say research and development at the time, and what I would say forensic crime labs throughout the country were just beginning to come online with one type of DNA analysis at that time.
Would it be correct to say that DNA analysis was kind of in its infancy in 1990?
Yes.
As a criminalist in 1990, what types of work did you do then?
Back in 1990, we would have been doing serological analysis, which again would be an attempt to identify biological fluids, such as blood, seminal fluid, saliva, and urine. Also from that, once we would identify a biological fluid, we would attempt to do what was called conventional serological typing in an attempt to differentiate individuals based on, for example, their ABO blood type. And if I could give a little example, most of you hopefully may know about your ABO blood type. You can be a group A, group B, group O, or group AB. And that's what we would be attempting to do is attempt to determine your ABO blood type from either your blood, but also from other biological fluids such as urine, saliva, or semen.
But defense attorney Aaron Haubacher suggested that cost may have been the reason DNA tests weren't performed.
There was DNA analysis, or at least the idea of DNA markers back in 1990.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, the first cases to use that in criminal court, in your line of work, happened well before 1990.
Several years before, yes.
It was known. Right?
Yes.
DNA analysis costs money.
DNA analysis is quite expensive.
And, it's gotten cheaper, but I mean, there was one reason why the state stayed away.
That was one of the reasons we did not come online right away with DNA analysis in the late 80s was due to cost, yes.
Right, at least for Iowa.
Correct, for Iowa.
You can't speak to the lab status of Illinois, New York, California, or the federal government for that matter, can you?
Correct.
Okay. And how long were you at the department? When did you start at DCI Department of Homeland Security?
I started at the DCI CRAM lab in 1982.
You didn't happen at all to work on a case involving an individual named James Clint, did you? K-L-I-N-D-T.
I was in the laboratory at the time. I did not do any analysis specific to that case.
In 1983, Davenport, Iowa chiropractor James Clint murdered his wife, Joyce, dismembered her body, and dumped it in the Mississippi River. The case was prosecuted by Bill Davis. Her torso, recovered from the river, was identified using genetic markers, one of the first such cases in the world. It established the legal foundation for DNA evidence in criminal cases.
And in fact, that the idea of genetic markers that existed back in the 90s, there was some testing capabilities for in different labs throughout the United States. You did have that capability to send them, send it out any sample you had to those labs.
What I would say there was, again, a different type of DNA analysis that was done back in the late 80s, early 90s. One was called restriction fragment length polymorphism, another known as D1S80, and another called dot blots that was kind of the precursor to what we're doing today. The RFLP that was really going on in about 1990 or so, about 87 through about 92, was a technique that was out there, very labor intensive, not very sensitive. You needed a lot bigger sample to do the DNA testing, that RFLP testing, than what we do today. It's probably like 100 or 1,000 times more sample than what we can test today.
Still testable if they had it?
Possible.
Possible. Do you know, did your agency take any steps to seek out any other labs across the country that might have a little better sophistication, at least not amongst the staff necessarily, but the equipment? Did they send it out to any place?
As far as I'm aware, in this case is concerned, no other requests were made for additional external DNA analysis at that time.
Aaron Haubacher may be laying the groundwork to ask why Scott County, Iowa, pioneered a form of genetic marker testing in 1983 in the prosecution of a wealthy chiropractor, but didn't use it 7 years later in the Stanley Liggins case. But criminalist Bush said there simply wasn't any evidence on Jennifer's body to test for DNA. The 9-year-old girl's body had been douched with gasoline and then ignited. If semen were present, the fire likely would have destroyed it, Bush said. Earlier this week, you may recall, world-renowned jury consultant Robert Hirshhorn predicted this about how prosecutors will go about selecting a jury.
So each side has 10 peremptory strikes that they can exercise against any juror they want. Now, they don't have to subscribe a reason, but under a Supreme Court case called Batson versus Kentucky, you cannot systematically exclude. You cannot take jurors off preemptorily based on their race. There's another case that says you can't do it based on gender. So what we want to look for is of those 4 or 5 remaining African Americans that are on the panel, we want to see how many of those the state exercise a peremptory strike on. My guess is, if I had a guess right now, if there's, say, 5, my guess is they're going to exercise 3 to 4 peremptory strikes to black jurors.
Well, he was wrong. Suspect convictions has learned that none of the African Americans selected are alternates. That means 3 African Americans and a person of mixed race are on the panel of 12 that will determine Stanley Liggins' fate. The previous 2 juries that convicted Liggins were both entirely white. Both convictions were later overturned by Iowa appellate courts. Folks, I want to talk to you about a terrific company. It's called Care Of. Care-of is a monthly subscription vitamin service that delivers completely personalized vitamin and supplement packs right to your door. Care-of's fun online quiz asks you about your diet, health goals, and lifestyle choices, and takes only 5 minutes to find out what vitamins and supplements you specifically need. Now, let me tell you a story. I have a problem, or I should say I had a problem, with nodding off in the middle of the day. I have trouble sleeping at night. I'm not sure why that is, And I put that into the quiz, and it came back and said I needed to be taking more magnesium. Now, I'm a reporter, so I'm skeptical by nature, and I'm thinking, maybe, but maybe not. I don't know. I just took an online quiz. So I called up my doctor's office and asked the nurse, hey, look at my last blood workup. Was I short of any particular vitamins or minerals? And she looks it up and says, yeah, you're a little bit low on magnesium. I'm thinking, maybe there is something to this quiz. So I started taking magnesium from Care-of. And you know what? I'm sleeping great at night. I haven't nodded off in the middle of the day since I started taking this magnesium and some other vitamins. And at church, where I was notorious for falling asleep in the pew, I'm wide awake and throughout the service. It's wonderful. And, you know, I'm not alone. 90% of people fall short of FDA recommended guidelines for at least one vitamin or nutrient. Take Care-of's quiz and get the vitamins you need to get back on track and reach your health goals. Do it like I did. Your vitamins get delivered right to your door in personalized, easy to remember daily packs, perfect for a busy, on-the-go lifestyle like you and I have. Care-of puts honesty first, providing all the research that supports each of their recommendations backed by a scientific advisory board. For 25% off your first month of personalized Care-of vitamins, visit takecareof.com and enter the promo code SUSPECT. Again, for 25% off of your first month of personalized Care-of vitamins, visit takecareof.com and enter the promo code SUSPECT. One more time, visit TakeCareof.com and enter the promo code SUSPECT and for 25% off your first month's subscription. I really recommend this company, folks. I love their product, and it's changed my life.
I'm Benjamin Payne with WVIK Quad Cities NPR. Scott Reeder joins me now over Skype. He's in Waterloo, Iowa, covering the retrial of Stanley Liggins. We've now reached the end of day four of this retrial, which wrapped up Friday, August 31st. On day three of the trial, the jury was finalized and opening statements were made by the prosecution. The defense opted to not give an opening statement. Day three also had some testimony with the prosecution calling up some people to the stand. So, Scott, thanks for joining me.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
What was in the store for day four?
Well, we had two women testify that, one testified in proxy. She passed away over the last 28 years. So somebody read her testimony from a previous trial. And another woman who's still alive, they came and they talked about having seen Jennifer Lewis near Stanley Liggins' vehicle the day of the murder. And they were neighborhood women who had observed Jennifer playing with their kids and running around the neighborhood, and they had observed her interacting with Stanley that day. I thought that was very compelling testimony. They also had a retired Davenport police detective come in and testify about how he did surveillance on Stanley Liggins before he was arrested because he was a suspect, and watched his car and followed him around covertly. And then he also measured how long it takes to drive from different points in Rock Island, where Stanley Liggins lived, over at the Hillside Motel, over by home where Jennifer Lewis lived, the different spots. And I think they're trying to bring home to people that, yes, Jennifer lived in one state and her body was found in another state, but the Quad Cities is all pretty close together. I mean, for us that live there or have lived there, that's a, you know, no kidding. I mean, you know, you can get across the community, get across the town in 10 minutes from Davenport to Rock Island. I mean, heck, when I worked for the Quad City Times, the drive from my home in Rock Island, Illinois, to the Quad City Times building in Davenport was 5 minutes. So, you know, I think they're trying to bring that home. But what I found really interesting is when they brought in a criminalist from the Department of Criminal Investigation for the state of Iowa. He did a lot of the forensic work for this case, and they interviewed him about that.
And what did he discuss?
Well, they talked about several things. One they talked about was, as you may remember, when Jennifer's body was found, it had been wrapped in a plastic garbage bag. And it was, you know, of course, the bag had melted when she was set on fire. But what he did is he compared the chemical content of the plastic bags with the bags that were available at the hotel where Stanley was living. And he said that they were very unique. They contained titanium. And most trash bags didn't at that era. And he talked about they had about the same thickness and talked about a variety of other things that would seem to indicate that perhaps the bags that Stanley would have readily available to him at the motel also could be used, be the one that was on Jennifer Lewis the night of her murder. But we also, the bigger thing was that I touched on was the issue of DNA. You know, in 1990, DNA was really at its infancy as far as DNA testing, that sort of thing. It had been done in a few cases before. The state of Iowa's lab back then wasn't yet doing DNA testing. But the guy who was testifying said, you know, what's interesting is there was nothing to test because they didn't recover any genetic material. And the reason is, I mean, this is kind of sad. I mean, it's sad, but it's also kind of gross. Whoever committed this crime against Jennifer essentially douched her out with gasoline and set it on fire. So there wasn't any DNA evidence to collect. But also he pointed out that, you know, they looked for evidence of genetic evidence that perhaps Jennifer had been in Stanley's hotel room, or they had looked for evidence that maybe she'd been in his car or other place, or to see if Stanley's DNA showed up at the place where the body was dumped, and they never found anything. And we're talking about thousands of items of evidence that were examined, and they didn't find anything back and forth. Now, of course, we know that the absence of evidence does not necessarily indicate innocence. You know, you could touch something and not leave a fingerprint. That doesn't mean you didn't touch it. So same thing deal with DNA. But I think we're seeing what's going to be a theme from the defense. You know, the absence of they're going to really challenge the credibility of this investigation, focusing in on there's no very little in the way of forensic evidence linking the two together in this crime. They're going to point to how they believe the police conducted a faulty investigation. They're going to challenge the not only the credibility of the police, but the honesty of the Davenport Police Department. And they're going to really look at some issues. And, you know, and there's some valid issues to look at. One of them is the whole issue of this key witness in the case, who being a, having been a paid police informant in 87 other cases, you have to, one has to wonder about her credibility. And that was, of course, never disclosed to the defense. And that's one of the reasons why Stanley Liggins got a new trial. And that's why we're trying this all over again in 2018.
And I understand that Stanley Liggins' brother came to the courtroom. What was he doing there?
I think he was just there for support for Stanley. His brother, Marvin Porter, came up from East St. Louis. I've interviewed Marvin before. I had a nice dinner with him a couple years ago at the Cracker Barrel in near East St. Louis. And a very nice person. I think he just wanted to come up and with his girlfriend and show some support for Stanley.
And tell me about the jury. Has the jury seemed to settle into the courtroom? This Blackhawk County Courthouse is practically going to be their second home for the next few weeks until this retrial is done.
Well, here's a little bit of news for you. When we chatted yesterday, we didn't know. We knew that there were three African-Americans and somebody else of mixed race on the jury panel, but we didn't know how many of them were alternates and how many of them were jurors. And we now know that all four of those people are on the jury itself. So fully one third of the jury is minority, which is much different than the first two trials where he had all white juries judging his case.
And that's pretty significant in this case because Stanley Liggins is African-American.
Not only is Stanley Liggins African-American, Jennifer Lewis, of course, was white. So this case has always had strong racial overtones from the very beginning. And it's an issue to this day when you talk to Quad Cityans from that era. You'll still hear people in the African community say, well, he was set up, he didn't do this. You'll hear people, it's still an issue for many people. And I think, so he's going to be judged by a diverse group of people.
And what can we expect for day five when proceedings pick back up on Monday?
Well, actually, they aren't going to pick up on Monday. It's Labor Day.
Ah, yes.
So they're going to be picking up on Tuesday. Well, I ran into Don Schaefer, who is the former Davenport police chief. But he was at the time the lieutenant in charge of the Detective Bureau, and he led this investigation. I ran into him at a Mexican restaurant over lunch in downtown Waterloo, and I asked him, when do you expect to testify? And he said he thought it would probably be on Tuesday, but those things can change. Trial strategies can change, so we'll see. But I think that'll be a really interesting cross-examination when he does occur, because he's the epicenter of all of this investigation.
All right. Well, is there anything else you wanted to mention, Scott?
I think it's a very interesting case, and we're going to have continue to be committed to providing our listeners with as much information about it as we possibly can.
All right. Thanks for joining me, Scott.
Thank you. Take care.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Do you like true crime podcasts which feature narration, music, sound effects, and real-life audio clips? Then Obscura, a true crime podcast, could be a good fit. Don't just take my word for it. Here's a preview of the show to help you make up your mind. Carol sat reading in her room. She had trouble reading the words on the page. Reading on vacation always seemed like a great idea, but as an adult, Sometimes your nerves were wound tight. Relaxing doesn't always come easy. Girls were very excited to arrive in Yosemite, in a way that only those with their entire future in front of them could be. No crushing weight of bills, no abandoned dreams. Carol herself had spent months saving up for this trip. A knock came at the motel door. The girls looked to Carol to answer the door. At home, Julie was always quick to answer the door, and seemed that the insureness of the new place was enough to reinstate Carol as the protector. Still, Carol gave pause. "Who is it?" she asked at the door. "Hotel maintenance," the man at the other side answered. A small pause passed. Then, the man continued. "There's a leak in your wing of the 500 building. I need to find the source." Julie and Sylvina were now looking through a crack in the curtain. Their movie abandoned. "Can't you come tomorrow?" Carol asked. Man seemed slightly more impatient this time. "Ma'am, it's a leak. These things can get serious. If we let it run all night, who knows what kind of damage there will be in the morning." "It can't be that bad," Carol answered back. "It's late, and we're just trying to relax." "Listen," the maintenance man returned. "I just need to find the source, and I'll be out of your hair. If that water seeps into the sheetrock, we'll have to move you in another room altogether. We both don't want that." Another pause. This one seemed like ages. The girls were not looking out the window now. Just at Carol. They had nothing to offer in this situation. Something in her stomach, or the situation is wrong. Maybe if she could just... "Okay, I don't need this." The man sounded totally impatient now. "I'm going to get my manager. We'll move you to another building." "Wait," Carol called out to the man's back. When Carrie Stainer turned around, he saw Carol standing in the doorway. The door wide open. "Easy prey," he thought to himself again. If you like what you heard, consider subscribing. We release new episodes every Wednesday. Thank you for listening, and take care.